Welcome back to Indigenous Oracle. I am so honored today to be speaking to my beautiful friend, Lillian Thorne. Lillian and I have known each other for probably close to 20 years, around 20 years, would you say?
Yes.
And I feel like I already knew her before I met her because her lovely mother was my boss at the treatment center we both worked at, and she talked about her kids all the time, and like we all did, and with great respect and love and laughter. So I feel like I already knew I would get along with Lillian before I even met her. So we hit it off, and we have a lot in common. And so Lillian, I'm going to hand it over to you, and if you just want to introduce yourself, and then maybe just tell us a little bit about that treatment center where we worked before we kind of flip backwards to earlier times in your life.
All right. Good afternoon. Thank you so much for that beautiful introduction, Janice. My name is Lillian Thorne, as Janice says. My maiden name is Jones, and I take that name from Nanaimo area, Snanaimoch, and my traditional name is Selchamia, which comes from Snoutnois, and that is my father, Sikaltanat's father, who is late Sam Bob. And I'm, of course, a daughter and a mom and a grandma, which I love being the most, a niece, a sister, and all of those beautiful things that I cherish of them about family. And a little bit about the treatment center called Sautin Lalem is that place is really important to me because my grandparents, Sam and Emily, told me that they would be a part of band meetings long before the center was built about needing a place for Indigenous people to go and heal. Now, growing up for me, I would remember them offering the same type of services that was offered at Sautin Lalem. So to see that at that stage of my life offered by people like Janice, like yourself, like my father, like my aunts and uncles, Jeff and Mitzi, and the many counselors that I've seen, I feel like everybody in the center, whether it was the counselor, myself, like a receptionist, a cook, a cleaner, no matter what role we did in the center, we all gave to the people coming through. And I feel like they gave to us more than we gave to them because they had nuggets that we were longing for in our healing. And so I feel like it went both ways. And that part of my life really helped me to be the person I am today with what I do.
Me too. Me too. I honestly believe I grew up in the treatment center. I started before I was 30 and I left right around the time I was 50 or right before I was 50. And yeah, I grew up there. I spent a lot more time there than you, but I mean, you spent longer there as your mom was an executive director for years. And what did I want to say about that? Oh, I wanted to say that. So it had alcohol and drug treatment programs. It still does, but it's a different iteration in a different town now. Alcohol and drug programs, but trauma treatment programs for residential school survivors and their family, codependency programs, and grief and loss programs were ran out of that center, as well as the program that I was on the longest was the Resolution Health Support Program, where we traveled to all different communities through the truth and reconciliation process, through the independent assessment process where residential school survivors were went to through a legal process for the harms caused in residential school. And then in the end, responding the last few years after those processes had wrapped up, we were traveling with a cultural support team for crisis response in communities. So very, very rich, beautiful center that is definitely kind of holds Lily and I's beginning of our friendship, or as I like to call it, our mutual adoration committee with two members, built of two members. We had a lot of laughter, a lot of tears, celebrations, and yeah, I've been telling Lillian directly myself over the years what an inspiration I believe she is in the things that she's achieved. So she's just going to tell us a little bit about where she came from and some of the pivotal points in her life, just to demonstrate what it is that I have always seen and admired about her.
Before I answer that question, I'll mirror back the admiration, first of all, because I feel like that is that's what connects me to you. And from the moment I met you, I see a mirror, and whatever that's about, whether that's about how we feel about being mothers or being women of our communities who want healing and intergenerational healing, whether that's because we love to dance or laugh, or whether that's because we're promoters and we understand the same language. I really appreciate all of that.
Thank you. Thank you. Sorry. And you just reminded me about this thing where we also talked about, because we're promoters, which means we're raging extroverts, and we both have our firstborn daughters are introverts. And we used to talk about having support groups for introverted daughters of extroverted moms, because it's a thing. It's definitely, yeah. Well, for me, it's really been a thing. So that was another thing that we connected on. And yeah. And I think that's what we really appreciated, is that we were going to stop at nothing to do our best to break cycles and be the best moms we possibly could be. And I think we see that in each other. They're, as my friend said, leave no stone unturned.
Are you on mute? I feel like where I've come from, of course, Snout Nois, and the vision or the dream of healing that my grandparents left behind, and all of the elders that they worked with there, like Auntie Mitzi and Uncle Jeff's parents, late Granny Ann Bob and Grandpa Jim, and late Elwood Bob, late Dave Bob, Senior and Junior. All of these beautiful people, late Peggy Edwards and Len Edwards, who recognized long before any of us knew that drinking was a problem, and that I would see one uncle drop by my house drunk all the time growing up, and my grandpa never being angry or expressing anger after he left, but always just coaching him through that time with such a gentle heart. And so arriving at Sautin Leilam was definitely where I was meant to be, because my grandparents died before I started working there. And my dad was a janitor when I was still in middle school. So I used to think when my parents worked there, when you say grew up in the treatment center, I used to think my parents could read minds. Like, that's what I thought counselors could do. So I hated counseling. I didn't want nothing to do with it. I remember going to family counseling thinking, this is the stupidest thing I've ever gone through in my life. And as soon as I can get old enough to get away from you people and you crazy alien like behaviors, I'm leaving all of you. And lo and behold, they do what's my greatest passion. They talk about the truth. And I'm so grateful for my parents for pushing and pushing, and my grandparents for pushing, and each generation for pushing. So I haven't been to a place like Sautin Leilam since I've left Sautin Leilam. I find pockets of people who are like that, who want to talk about the truth. And the pockets I feel like are getting bigger, but they're not big enough that they stop sexual abuse or physical abuse or suicide or incest. Like, those things are still happening, and on a greater scale than they were before. And so I feel like in that way, my job will never be done. And it might take, like I've heard, those seven generations. And that's what I'm grateful for about the center, because I've never lost hope. And I mean, I repeat David Somerville all the time, that some of our people are going to die wounded and some of us are going to come out of it. And we just have to keep trying. Like you said about an individual, some people come to this level to have a really hard life. And I need to be able to have faith in the ancestors and each person's path. that I don't need to interrupt people's journey, that I can be there to love them no matter what, like my grandpa did. And so I feel like Soten Lalem has really solidified me in that way.
I really relate to that. I have received a teaching from Elsie Robinson to respect my siblings' journey. I used to feel sorry for them or feel like they should have the journey that I'm having, or they should find the path I'm on. And it was really driven home to me that's their journey. It's not higher or lower or better. No one's behind or above. They're in their journey exactly where they're supposed to be. And I mind my own vibration. And also she said, when you run across family and loved ones who you're worried about, give them 100% undivided attention in the moment. But when you leave, don't carry them with you, which just gave me so much freedom to be present. And Ree Samuel emulates that too. Doesn't matter what she's going through with family and dark places and times, she shows up to work, which was on the road, you know, in the communities, smiling, laughing, and ready to shine her light wherever she ends up. So these women have really, really paved the way and shown the way. And all I can think is, you know, if our daughters kept us going and then our grandchildren keep us going, I can only imagine that that's what keeps them going. Like, how could we ever expect our children to find the light or be in the light if we're not role modeling that? Right. And so sometimes it feels like, how am I still thriving and shining when others are suffering? But it's that's what someone has to do. That someone has to hold that part while other people's lights might be dampened for a while. And then someone else will step in and be the light when I'm there, but we always have to keep that path clear for the people if it's the road that they signed up to take, then we can light it. Anyways, I'm getting really proverbial. It's crazy, but yeah, we really are mirrors for each other about what's most important to us. And I love how I always said that I worked at Soten Lalem for 10 years with my five years with my master's degree. And I never told anybody the words, I have my master's degree, never came out in my work ever. And then people would say, the people want to know if you care, they don't care what you know. And I'm like, yep, that sums it up. Because then I would be asked to speak somewhere and I would mention that I had my master's degree. I'm like, thanks for letting me say that. Like, that's just never relevant to my life, but I did get that done. So I like how we've gotten this far in the conversation and those pieces haven't even come into play yet. And I could interrupt you a million times because I was thinking about when I applied at Soten Lalem in 1999, Yvonne, your mom was serving the coffee. I didn't know that she was the program director. She was just serving the coffee. And I said to her, all I know is that I knew we were going to do personality tests and psychological assessments. And I said, I just know that I operate from my heart and I wear my heart on my sleeve, but I'm not very good, like logical or math or anything like that. And she's like, you know what? That's exactly what we're looking for at Soten Lalem.
Amazing.
Lo and behold, we land here, and what are we talking about? Right?
Exactly.
The heart.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The heart. Yeah. Okay, so talked about Soten Lalem and how your grandparents just without even knowing it, well, they probably knew it, but without you knowing it, were just priming you to be this same unconditional loving presence in community for the younger people now that were coming up under you, which leads to your job today. Is that the next natural place for you to go? Or do you want to talk about things along the way that kept you going or anything that's on your heart you can launch into?
That feels like the next natural place to go.
Where you work? I heard you on the weekend say, And that's what I'm here for. And you're like a handful of people I know that have landed in their purpose, and people who know what they're here to do just have this, oh my God, I'm sounding so, I don't know, but it's, I mean it authentically. They glow a different way. There's a woman who makes these crocheted fairies and things like that. She's selling with her babies, and just like, it's just a heart. You can just tell it comes from the heart after all the things she's tried. Narissa with her sound healing. She's been a singer all this time, but now she is a healer singer, you know, like, and then when you said that, I felt that, I believe that it's like this, I know what I'm here to do, and I get to do it. Wow.
I'm so grateful that you had Corinne there too. She feels like natural at what she does, and yourself at like with whatever you've done, I've always admired the things you've been able to do. And that was just a beautiful crowd. What a great job you did that day.
Thank you. Thank you so much for saying that. Back to Lillian.
What were we talking about again?
Lillian Thorne, and her maiden name is Jones. And she came from some really challenging stuff in her childhood, but she also came from a lot of love. Mm-hmm. She is the daughter of one residential school survivor or two residential school survivors?
Two.
And I don't know if I've ever said this on this show, but my grandfather went to residential school. So that's the word intergenerational. That's what we mean, the next generation after that horrific, traumatic era in our history. And then Lillian, this sparkle of a human, talked about our laughter and our fun and what we learned from Selton Lalem and how that became a place for us to share our hearts. I'm just going to say before you launch into yours, when you got your teaching degree, I remember this is the thing about Selton Lalem, like you said, tell the truth. Well, yeah, like when you showed up, it was about yourself. It wasn't about systems and unions and whatever. It was just like, it was always a workshop on like yourself, always shining a mirror and a light on yourself. And it was exhausting sometimes, but sometimes that presented itself in, like you said, the honesty of having to look at yourself and the honesty of the conversations also meant that we told each other what we appreciated about each other. We celebrated each other. Your mom, Yvonne, was so big on, and we have to celebrate. And we have to tell people when there's something good. And we need time for laughter and fun. And so I told you what it meant to me when you graduated with your teaching degree, what it meant. And when I work with you in the school system, when you invited me to come to the school system with the elders, I was just like, yeah, just showing up, looking like your students, being from the same territory as your students, having similar stories to your students, and then showing up ready to love them and in this position of, you know, someone who is there to care for them. That was enough. You didn't need to even open your mouth. Just showing up. And then just to provide that, like I say, that unconditional love in that safe place. So that was your teaching degree, which was a bit of a journey, but now it's landed you. What do you want to tell us a little bit about where you are and what you do?
Yeah, I feel like there's one thing I think about that I constantly work on since I've been little, and I grew to feel like I've hated myself all my life. And I remember feeling that when I was little. And so becoming a teacher, that was one thing I never really wanted to look at because, you know, we're told to have a self-esteem and to have positive self-talk. And so I try to do the things. And then I meet all of these Indigenous students when I first became a teacher who really didn't like themselves. And I remember trying to tell them all the same things that was told to me. This is what you do. This is what you do. And And then realizing, oh, okay, I don't actually have to say anything. I can sit underneath the table with a student who's completely shut down, and we're in a school while school things are happening around us. We could even be in a classroom full of 30 kids that are super loud, and we're just underneath the table, the two of us. And I think the first time I realized that that's what I'm there to do is sit with people that really hate themselves, that can't say that out loud, and we're just going to sit together. And I think the first time it happened, we sat for 2 hours. Finally, a question came to me that, again, I think it was David Somerville who said to me, I'm just a vessel. That is all I am. And really feeling that just a vessel at that moment, because I said, he looked at me. I could tell he was present again. What caused you to sit here so that sitting here isn't something you feel like you need to do again? Well, my EA said something to me in this tone. Oh, she did. I feel like your EA loves you so much and has known you longer than I have, that if it's okay with you, I could tell her what she sounded like to you so that she never sounds like that to you again, only if it's okay with you. Yes, he said. So instantly the EA was completely heartbroken that she wasn't what we know of today, trauma-informed. So she realized that her voice was going to change to accommodate his need. And this boy ended up finishing school without my support. And that's exactly what I feel like I want to do, is be with kids so I can work myself out of a job and move to the next kid. Some kids need to find themselves, like how I found myself. And I think it's them who really inspire me to, and like, it's also my children, you know, it's also my granddaughter, like, especially Alana, because like you say, I don't want her to see grandma hating herself. And one day I'm gone and Lana thinks the answer is to hate herself. I want Lana to see grandma being in love with herself. So Lana's in love with herself, and that's just what seems natural to her.
I love this, and I love that. Oh, damn. I love that. And I love that you mentioned trauma-informed, because when I learned what trauma-informed practice was, and I did all this training, and I couldn't get it, and I was like, you mean what we've been doing all along? Like, we honestly got bussed to the military place in Victoria. We had some training on crisis intervention. They did a 3-hour presentation for our whole team. And at the end, they said, so people aren't bad. They're actually just like traumatized or hurt. And I'm like, seriously, Russell? And then the elders were like, is that really what the moral of this story is? And so I would always say, when I was learning about trauma-informed practice, that EAs, and not that we're perfect at it, but teachers, we really were always acting in a trauma-informed way, where we were caring about what the kids' needs were, where we were looking underneath the behavior for what else could be going on, where we always knew the reason wasn't for attention, but for connection, where we always knew that the child, the best person to tell us what was happening for the child, it's their child themselves, where it's just this relational piece. That when I worked in schools as a youth worker after I was an EA, I loved bringing the youth to their EAs that had known their families and were from their communities. And I always knew they'd be taken care of no matter what happened out there and what we were dealing with. I knew that they would be seen and heard and unconditionally held in those rooms and spaces when I brought them there. So yeah, it really is something that comes natural in our communities, and it's, we're a big part of that in schools. We're a big part of that.
So now you're a, what kind of teacher are you now? A support?
I'm a special education teacher. I work with students one-on-one or in a group, and I support teachers who need help supporting their students. So basically, what that looks like is that every single student that is diagnosed with anything, are on my caseload. So I have 75 students on my caseload, which is almost about 90% of the population that are in the school. And I write their IEPs and contact their families and work with them as best as I can at the age level they're at. And I feel like we have come a long way in being able to talk about students that have whatever diagnosis means. I've gone through a process where I didn't believe in that, but I feel like what I understand from working with psychologists and speech and language pathologists is that we need to learn what students are good at and what they are challenged with, and make sure we're not pushing them in areas that they can't be pushed in. And so that for me is why I feel comfortable doing what I do.
I love that. And I remember when I was getting my master's degree the same time you're getting your teaching degree. And I remember going to Mitzi and Lisa and saying, oh my gosh, I know why I have this block on my education and why I can't get it done. And they're like, why? I'm like, it's like part of it's like residential school legacy. And they're like, you're just figuring that out now. They're like, that just occurred to you after watching me struggle for years and years and have breakdowns and need coaching and all this stuff. And then you finished, I think, before I finished. And I know that you struggled. So I'm wondering, when you went to your master's degree, did you struggle in the same way, or did different things come up as roadblocks, or did you feel like you'd already paved the way?
I was working in a system, and still a system that's completely breaking down every single year. And at the time, culture is really what gets me through. So I had my first teacher compassion fatigue or teacher burnout in the fifth year I taught. And I was going through exactly what the students were going through. The students were helpless in a public school system. And as a teacher, I was helpless in that same system because the white people that were supervising me didn't understand what trauma-informed looked like, because that wasn't the language back then. The language was, we need to get kids to read and write and be at grade level with other kids as fast as possible. So you do your magic, whatever that is, and show us some data that kids are improving. Of course, I didn't know what to do and how to do that. And I was getting to know students before I attempted to get them to read or do the things that I was supposed to do. So I was told that I was not allowed to work with students anymore in the public school system, and that they cut my job down that was supposed to be continuing until I retired, until I chose to leave, that I was given an afternoon a week rather than full time because of my inability to just get kids to do academic work. And I gave them too much talk time. So at that time, I felt like it was a perfect time for me to go to do my master's so that I could understand why I am the way I am and why I give kids so much time to talk about their lives before I get them to do the things they have to do. And so in 4 years of studying people like Dr. Bruce Perry, Dr. Bessel van der Kolk, and those are two of my favorite people, I really came to understand that I don't need to be a counselor to work with kids in trauma, that I need to be a warm body with a heart. And that's really all they need, that they don't, you know, people say, oh, you're having trauma, go see a counselor. They don't actually need a counselor. They need a warm body with a heart. Mm-hmm. And I'm grateful that these psychologists, every single article or book that I read, that this was repeated to me, because I felt like, okay, I'm okay. You know, I'm not a bad person. I shouldn't quit teaching. I'm okay. And I spent 9 months in my husband's parents' basement, and I only left their basement to get food. And thank goodness somehow along the way, like, Sam wasn't there. So she physically wasn't there. Like, she was living with my parents. And so I didn't have to take care of her at that time. And my dad told me that what happened for me in that system was that when the kids told me about their traumas, I got down in their shit with them and I tasted their shit. I felt it. I smelt it. And what I should have done was reach my hand down, just like when my daughters were learning to walk and they would fall down. I didn't say, ha, 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 Sam and Tori, you're never going to get this. No, I put my hand out and I said, get up, baby. He said, that's what you need to do when kids are telling you their traumas. Oh, I don't have to feel it with them. No. Okay. So that was kind of my first teaching and my first cultural teaching in my work with trauma with kids. And so from that point on, I did not get down on the ground anymore. And I learned how to be happy going to work with kids who are suicidal and who hated themselves and still be happy. And that, like you're saying, that's what they need. So for me, it's about the things my grandma taught me to do. It's the daily getting up before the sun comes up and putting cold water on my body and thanking the creator for another day and feeding my body with some good food so that when I see my granddaughter or a student who hates themselves, how can I be full of energy and love? Not a half full, not a quarter full, but so full that, you know, I'd only known this one kid for January, February, March, April, 3 months. And after knowing him for 3 months, he's now asking me to give him reminders on a daily basis to brush his teeth so his gums won't be bleeding anymore, to help him get braces, to help him get a six pack, to help him quit eating the way that he is so that he can get, he would like a real fit body. And so for me, it's not about having a master's degree. I feel like if I can't give what little knowledge I have so that someone takes it and makes it their own knowledge, if I'm not doing that, then I'm not doing my job. And it's not about sitting with a kid and telling them and hanging my master's degree in my office while I'm teaching them how to read. Like, my master's degree is right there. So when I watch TV, I'm like, I remind myself how smart I am and that I can study for 5 years and go through hell and feel like I'm going to quit. And I quit my job halfway through that master's degree. And some people get supported in their master's and in education to become certain things. I never had that. And so I think that's why it took me a little bit longer to find my special education position. I had to find someone who believed in me. And I found that one person who believed in me, who hired me without a special education kind of classified diploma. And I'm working on that diploma now, but that when I think about education culturally, Janice, my parents are alive. So when it comes to trauma, I'm not allowed to lead culturally because they're alive and their voice is, when they move, I move. When they speak, I listen. So I take a real listener seat when it comes to culture. So I've been really kind of balancing my life like that and not speaking as much as I used to. And so really, my outlet when I talk about trauma or what my ideas of trauma are or my own story or how does what I deal with every day as an educator impact who I am today, the only space I have to talk about that is education. So that's why I strive so hard to get the master's, to apply for a doctorate, to learn so many things, because I know my place, and my place is, you know, I have to be quiet.
Yeah. Thank you for that reminder too, right? We're always like, when do I step up and use my voice? And when do I sit back and let hold the space for someone else's voice. No, I love all of that you said, and you reminded me of one of my messages when I worked in the school to teachers was like, don't give up on these students or don't make judgments on like where they're going to be in their life. Because I'm one of very few of my friends that have a master's degree. Like, very few of us have a master's degree. And I was a high school dropout. I was a student they all were told not to hang out with. I was a student all the teachers were like, oh, I don't know what to do with her. And once in a while, a teacher would break through and see me and be there for me and recognize me. And I know those teachers by name. And so I remember saying that to some high school teachers, and they're like, oh, well, we do that, but the students just aren't receptive. And I believe that for a minute. I was like, were all these teachers trying to reach me? And it's like, no, I know who sincerely wanted to see me behind my messiness and my absenteeism. And I as a child who really sees you or is attempting to connect, right? And so that is what I think ends up being the magic. I call it unconditional, but it's like no strings attached. Like, one time I was working in the school as an Aboriginal EA, and this one young girl had had her, stuff happening in her family, very small family, big things happening, jail, hospitalization, these things. She was in grade 7, and I supported her all year, and I wasn't asked to do anything really with her schoolwork. Maybe I was, but not really. And I just always would talk to her and be present with her and listen to what was happening to her and just kind of be that person. And then the school year was coming to an end, and teachers were panicking and saying, she's not going to graduate. She's not going to graduate. And I was thinking, with the things going on in her life, I don't think that's her, like, she's not going to finish grade 7, right? I don't really think that that's her priority from what I know about her. And so they just kept pressuring me. So I went into this one of these last meetings of the year with this young woman, and I said to her, oh, the teacher was saying something about your math, and she just looked at me and her face dropped. Exactly what you said about, like, putting the student before, that's trauma-informed practice, putting the student before the task. And I just looked at her and said, I am so sorry. I am so sorry. Before I came in, this is what the teachers were saying. They were hounding me for 2 days. By the time I saw you, I thought that this was my role, but that is not my role. They can talk to you about your schoolwork. The principal can talk to you about your schoolwork. I'm here for you. What's happening in your life this week? And I don't know if I ever regained her trust again, but that is a illustration of exactly what you're talking about. These little students' hearts they have to feel safe coming to school and feel seen and heard and witnessed in order to feel comfortable and grounded and safe enough to actually learn anything anyways, right?
Unless their tummies are full and they feel like welcome, like they've arrived, like they're part of, they're connected, then it's really hard to get the other piece done anyway. Not that we've ever seen that as a priority, but it's obviously there in the school. Somebody thinks it's a priority. Sorry, I reached out to somebody about that, and she said it just means that sometimes when you put the relationship first and when you really hone into what that student needs, they just might graduate a year or two later. It's not the end of the world. But yeah, either that, you can push them out and push them to drop out because you just refuse to recognize what they really do need.
Exactly, Janice. And I think for me to having be the subject and the object of the population I work with, I was going through some things as a mother with my own daughter at times that were exactly like the students that could help me to really stop what I was doing for my daughter and to really understand the students. Like, I remember feeling so angry at Sam that I would ream her out on the way to school. And I can't imagine as a sweet 9-year-old what that would have made her day look like for her. But, you know, and there's no excuse for what I did. And having that's what was happening for me when I was her age. And then having a student come and say to me that same day that my mom was yelling at me this morning. My mom said, I'm good for nothing. My mom said, and I feel so stupid. And why should I do my work? My mom said, I'm going to be nobody anyway. Oh, wow. And so here I am getting this back from someone who, you know, I was doing that with my daughter just a couple of hours ago. And so at the time, I couldn't quite put the puzzles together. But through a lot of counseling and I did EMDR, which was one of the biggest pieces that I think helped me with my rage. And at Sautin Lalam, I heard people making self-care plans, but I've never made one myself until I realized how much of a monster I was as a mother, and that I couldn't not only do for my students, but I had to start believing my daughters when they told me that I was hurting them, that every single time they said that I had to believe them and not defend myself. And so I feel like that's another piece too that I see happening with my family, that we want to discipline our kids and make them respect their parents. Mm. That's all beautiful. But we also have to recognize that we've hurt our kids a lot, and they need a lot of space to talk about that. And so thank goodness through my teaching, kids could show me, and that's how I feel like they give back more to me. They've really showed me and gave me that gift of what kind of parent I was being. And I was, you know, like the pursuit says, was I being congruent? I'm saying I want to be a good mom, but I'm also pushing my kids away by being all these hurtful things. And so I'm really grateful for my work for that as well. I feel like my kids are the best assessors in terms of who I am as a mother. And if they can say I'm a good mom, then that's where I like to land on.
Mm-hmm. I love that. And we're talking about that honesty again too, right? And I remember sitting at Salt Lake and reading Gabor Mate's book. And at first she was like, if you did this to your children, this is the damage you caused. I'm like, oh no. And the next page is like, I just went on this roller coaster of like, oh my goodness, I broke my daughter. And then, oh my goodness, I was broken. And then, oh my goodness, I don't feel broken. So why am I treating my daughter like she's broken? You know, so it's like, there's one thing to be accountable, but there's another thing to see them beyond all that trauma too, because they're so resilient. And also know somewhere in that I was beating myself up for a few chapters. And then I got to this page where he was like, and none of this is done because of lack of love. None of these behaviors that we have enacted on our children is done out of lack of love for them. It's done because it was what was done to us. It's done because it's in our blood, because it's all we know. It's done for all of these legacy reasons that have nothing to do with how much or little we love our children. And that lifted me up. And when I was able to see myself as not broken, I was able to see my daughter as not broken. I don't want anyone feeling sorry for me. But that doesn't mean that we're like you say, we don't have to be honest and accountable and be the parent when they need to say, this is my truth. I love that. I feel like this is a great place to end, Lillian. How are you feeling?
Yeah, I feel really complete too, my beautiful friend. And I'm ready to eat lunch as well. I'm very hungry.
Well, I'm on my way to take the dogs out and get my hair cut. So yeah, I appreciate you so much. And I'm so glad I got to do this. It feels like I'm finally lining up with what this big push was to make me want to do a podcast, these conversations. So you take care and thank you.
I love you with all my heart. Thank you so much.
Thank you. And I hope you'll come on again and we'll think of a subject, something we have in common that we both love, and have another great conversation. Okay.
Anytime to hang out with you.
Okay. Take care, Grandma.
You too, Grandma.
I love you. Bye.
Love you. Bye.